Good evening and welcome to Art Waves. I'm Bernadette Rule, and tonight my guest is Stan White, the founder of The Feast. Stan White is the reason I started Art Waves in the first place, to be sure that you, dear listeners, could hear his inimitable voice reading his inimitable poetry. I love his work. So this is about the 10th time Stan has been on, but not for about 5 years. I think it's been a while since we've had him on. But he's back today, and I'm very happy for that. Stan White is a retired photographer. He's written nonfiction all his life and short stories and poetry for the last 35 or so years. He has published 4 books and numerous chapbooks, some in collaboration with other poets. Stan White lives in Brantford, Ontario, and this, as I said, is his 10th visit. Welcome back to Art Waves, Stan White. It's been far too long.
Thank you, Bernadette. It's always a pleasure to be here. And I think you say it's been about 6 years since we were here last time. So
yeah,
it's
crazy
good to be back. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, I was very interested in getting your take on several things. One is you turned 90 recently, and you're still writing, still going strong. And we're in the middle of the COVID-19 lockdown. So I want to start with that, which is on everyone's mind, the COVID-19. How are you navigating this lockdown?
Well, being retired, of course, it's one of the best positions to be in. Really, the only onus has been the necessity to isolate. And that came as a bit of a surprise to me, how much we all need to be in the proximity of other people. But it's a weird year for all of us, and I've still got my snow tires on.
Right. Yeah, no need to bother changing them. We're not driving anywhere, are we? I think I've had to get gas twice.
Everything slowed down.
It slowed right down. Yes, indeed it has. Has the pandemic found its place in your writing at all?
Well, I don't think this particular atmosphere that we're all in is particularly conducive to writing. And certainly my poet friends who have not really been tremendously productive. But I've written a few things.
Okay.
And one poem I'll read, if I may, it is called Surprise. Left only at the mercy of my own thoughts, they are tough. Sieve-like, the mind is porous, must have replenishment. My head cries out for trees, fools, especially people. And the other thing that I have written, not terribly important, but Ty Grove in his, I think, Hidden Press, invited people to submit pankus, which, loose speaking, are haikus about the pandemic. And so I did a few of those, and I'll read them to you, or
great,
one or two of them. Thank goodness it doesn't infect sardines. In solitary, the loneliest part of me is my tongue. Look out the window. Nobody is everywhere. No, stupid. Not that mask, Zorro.
Those are funny. You've got
it's been fun, yeah.
You've still got your wits about you. This is good.
Well, it's about the only thing, humor, I think, in this situation.
Yeah. Well, we need humor. We need everything we can get to bring to it as it stretches on and on. We are now in the 4th month of it, being in July 2020 right now as we speak. And of course, we're having to do this on a Zoom recording, where we can't really see each other very well, instead of in the studio. So I will ask our Art Waves listeners to forgive the occasional garbled sound, which is, I have no idea why it's happening or how to fix it. So unfortunately, that's just one of the problems. But If you hang in long enough, you will be very happy that you listened to Stan White tonight on Art Waves. You said in a recent article, Stan White, that prose writing is ideal for illustrating matter and energy. The medium of poetry can far more easily access the intangible. Can you enlarge on that idea?
I can, yes, but I think reading some further poems will perhaps illustrate it better than me trying to explain what I mean at this point.
Okay.
So I'll read you a piece that I wrote called Ars Poetica. And the way that this came about was that George Wibbs organized a poetry reading at our local art gallery, Brantford Glenhurst Art Gallery, a year or two ago. And it was for the purpose of promoting poetry. And I thought maybe since we didn't have to read our own works, we could read other people's too, that I would concentrate on the art of poetry. And Horace, of course, wrote the classic on Ars Poetica, but it was 700 and some odd pages long and wouldn't read that. But I did read Ars Poetica by the very famous American poet Archibald MacLeish, and I'd like to read that now too. A poem should be palpable and mute as a globed fruit, dumb as old medallions to the thumb. Silence, even one stone of casement ledges where the moss has grown. A poem should be wordless as the flight of birds. A poem should be motionless in time as the moon climbs, leaving as the moon releases twig by twig the night entangled trees, leaving as the moon behind the winter leaves, memory by memory, the mind. A poem should be motionless in time as the moon climbs. A poem should be equal to, not true, for all the history of grief, an empty doorway and a maple leaf. For love, the leaning grasses and two lights above the sea. A poem should not mean, but be. One poem, of course, very famous. I also figured, well, if Horace could write 700 and some odd pages on the art of poetry, it shouldn't be that difficult. So I wrote a piece myself, also called Ars Poetica. Ars Poetica. I write of stars and of the infinity behind mirrors and of the inconsequence of trifles. I write in the sound of sea in shells, and of the crescendo of silence in the light of an eye in the deep of sleep. I write between a memory and a forget, in the fading half-light at the end of days. And upon the eve of every eve, I write in the epilogues of myths of where the seaward runes once told of where a never is born and a forever ends. I write of where an echo fades and in the touch of a lover's hand and of where a rainbow strays. I write in the idiom of daydreamed days and in the sounds of tippos in the night and wake to a choristry of birds singing. I write in the loneliness of distant mountains and in the thirst of desert sands crave the tranquility of still waters. I write in the confusion of happening that the startled pheasant takes into the air. I write of a shoe that has never stepped, and of hem of the emperor's clothes, and of the weight of a sadness and a regret. I write of feeling falling fast, and in the seesaw of the tides. I write in the crevices of dawns, in the drone of the mumblebees, and of where a fall of wood smoke goes. I write in the synonym of time, and of the night side of the moon, and in the breath of fairy kneeling flowers, I write of stars.
Oh, you know, Stan, every time I read a poem of yours that just blows me to the ground, I think, well, this is it. This is, it doesn't get any better than this. It's not possible. This is his best one. But I've thought that so many times with your work. This Ars Poetica, I fell madly in love with it the moment I read it. You sent it to me in an email. And I've read it to a bunch of people, and all of them have wanted to copy it and send it on to other people. Everybody loves this poem. It's so perfectly beautiful.
Thank you, Bernadette. I really appreciate those comments. I would hope that maybe that poem illustrates a little of what I mean about being able to write about. And I think you said it very well the other day when we were having a discussion. You talked about words for things that can't be said.
Yes.
And I think that really is what I mean, and why, how poetry is, and I'll talk more about it later, but how poetry is particularly useful in this respect.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think your poetry, you know, who was it said that we don't get the news from poetry, but without it, we'd all die? Is that Wallace Stevens? It's so true. And that is one of the best examples I can think of, Stan White, your Ars Poetica. So gorgeous. Now, you have published several books, and of all of your books, you say that you think 2014's Oddities, is which is the most recent one, is the best, that's your favorite. Why do you say that?
Well, the book is I said that the book was my swan song, and I think it was, really. Possibly because I think it was my most creative book, and I did things with poems that I'd not previously done.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, sure. I'll read you a poem called Poem Written from the Inside. Now, when we write poetry, I think we write from our imagination. But obviously, our imagination has space in reality of the real world, of the actual. And we seldom give any recognition to this. And I thought perhaps one could, in a poem, do that. And I read you this poem, Poem Written from the Inside. The first lines of this poem I plucked from the sky while the sun was called away. They were loitering among clouds. I've laid them between hills under the word for tarn, so it will not billow should the wind blow, though a hindrance of beech trees forms a windbreak to the north, at which, in the interests of the poem, I assembled from a small coppice. Little girls are picking wildflowers further down the hill. I would have preferred them, in deference to the poem, to have been paddling in the shallows of the tarn, but felt it much too much to ask.
Yes, I see what you mean. You're playing with the concept of creation, creating a world, and it seems like you would have no limits, and yet, of course, there are limits to even our own creation. We still have parameters that we must fall into.
I read you another one that perhaps illustrates for much the same thing, called Poem of a Rainy Day. For the past week, I have been trying to figure how to put down a wet morning on paper, how to capture that translucent shoebox experience of the drab, the uncomfortable, how to bring the clouds low enough for that feeling of falling, yet not so low as to interfere with the eraser on the end of my pencil. I have had the adjective and nouns ready for several days. Cool, calm, quiet, dank, breath, heart, and figured a way that rain might make the trees purr. But the noun puddle has given me the most trouble, for the ink from my pen would run and my pencil would write it all on the wet paper. Come winter, I shall write of a snowfall. The white premium poppy, £24, should give little hindrance to pen or pencil under dry snow.
Oh, that's wonderful. You're doing exactly what good poetry does. You're not saying, you're not making statements. You're making suggestions. You are working out of the peripheral vision. It's all very indirect to describe the process of creating a poem, but it's quite wonderful.
Yeah, I read you a third poem from the book. You know, poems are dead once they are written. They don't age. But I figured, supposing that they did, what the poem sound like.
Okay.
Dear editor, I'm sending you an early poem which I am sorry to say has suffered badly from the passage of years. You will note all the verbs in the present tense of the original are now in the past. Is's are now was's, are's are now where's. And in the first stanza, the word polished table are barely readable under a thick layer of dust. In the second, the energetic lady hiker who had no difficulty in bounding up and down hills and vaulting streams at the time the poem was written is now scarcely able to navigate without the use of a walker and help from her husband, the gentleman in the third stanza with the long beard and the deerstalker cap. I assure you the mouldy, half-eaten sandwich tossed casually into Aspidestra, verse 3, fourth line, was not there in the original poem, and I have done my best to clean up the crumbs. Be assured I have vacuumed the poem from beginning to end. It is, in the main, now quite sanitary, though I would advise against opening the door of the refrigerator you will find in the last line of the penultimate stanza. Cordially yours, etc.
Oh, Stan, you do make me laugh. That is wonderful. I love the moldy sandwich thrown into the Aspidistra. Oh, that's just great. Okay, well, you know, you in all of these, a person could write a very straightforward essay about what you're doing and what you're saying about poetry, but the way you're saying it is oblique and much better than if you were to say it directly. Another place you have distilled your ideas about writing poetry is in the foreword to the book Oddities, the book that we're reading from, that you're reading from. Would you mind if I took a moment to read the foreword?
By all means.
Okay, this is from Stan White's foreword to his last book of poetry, Oddities, and that was published in 2014. He says, "It is difficult to imagine the process of thought in a world without words, but it suggests a world as a single, indivisible entity. Conversely, a world with language is inevitably shattered into a million shards, not all of which are obviously associated with others. Poetry is the most suitable discipline for putting them together again. Knowing that reality of our everyday living is not what it seems, and that everything, including ourselves, is a cluster of unbelievably small particles, all in continuous reaction to each other, inevitably affects the manner in which we must think of gods, souls, aspects of spirituality, and even consciousness itself. The process of writing poetry is that of taking the abstraction of thought and the intangibility of feelings and converting them to the actuality of words. Sadly, words and language are far less accommodating and the crude technology of writing even more so, such that sometimes the form of a poem is more important than its content. These are the unavoidable considerations that underlie every one of these poems. Stan J. White. Oh, I love the way you explain poetry. I just think it's quite spot on. Okay, so you don't shy away from talking about the fact that you've reached the generous age of 90, Stan White, and yet you seem to me exactly as you always were. I suppose I've known you for maybe 20 years, and you were always just exactly as you are now. Obviously, you have good genes, and you have had good luck as well, not to have been run over by a bus or something. But I know that you've also taken serious steps to stave off the dementia that plagues most nonagenarians. Can you tell me about some of those steps you've taken?
Well, I can't really say that they've made any difference, because, of course, you never know what you would have been like if you hadn't done them. But right. I take a cue from the gurus, the people who tell us that as we age, we should give our brains things to do that they haven't done before. And in a sense, I suppose poetry is very, very good for exercising the brain, because virtually every poem you write is different, of course, and it creates new difficulties each time you write. But I also learned to fly radio-controlled aircraft, which is, again, very good for old age, because if your reflexes don't sharpen up, you spend quite a lot of time doing repairs. And a couple of the things that I've done, because I'm a fanatic about music. I think it's a phenomenal... hard to say what to call it, but it is a phenomenon that I think exercises the brain simply by just listening to it. So I learned to play the musical saw, and I'm also learning to play the theremin. When I'm playing the theremin, I make sure that all the windows are closed.
Good. Nobody can hear you?
That's right. I don't want to offend the neighbors.
Well, the theremin is a very eerie sounding instrument in any case.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Where did you get your theremin?
Oh, the great thing about the internet, of course, is that you can live on a desert island as long as you've got the internet, because it tells you everything. And there's every niche interest. When you get onto the internet, there's always a crowd of people who are involved with it. So I got it, a matter of fact, from a music store in Toronto through Amazon, actually. So they're very available. It's an instrument that is coming into vogue again by the young people and in a lot of the rock bands. They don't play it the way they do.
Yeah. Well, you know, playing any musical instrument does call on different parts of your brain, I suppose. And whatever you're doing, it's working very well, because you sent me a poem that you had just written in late June called Figment. And Ars Poetica, when did you write that one?
Ars Poetica was written about 2 years ago.
Well, it's amazing. And this one that you wrote in June called Figment is another amazingly wonderful poem, I think as good as anything you or anyone has ever written. Would you read that one for me?
You often hear poets say that the reason they'll write a particular poem is that the first line is given to them.
Yeah.
And that occasionally, it doesn't happen enough, unfortunately, for most of us, but it does happen occasionally. And I always think back to Coleridge's Kubla Khan poem, and I read that and I think, well, the second verse looks like it's written by Coleridge, but the first verse looks like it was written by God. Because I don't know, the story, but of course he supposedly got the poem, at least the first part of the poem, out of an opium dream. He woke up and it was there. Yeah. So that does happen, and that happened to me with the poem
Figment.
I'm just looking for it here.
Okay.
Here it is, Figment. Figment. I took sleep through the woods last night, stopping to watch fireflies. But there was more than the mere space that darkness makes. A dream that took its mystery from the delight of times where love once tarried, extant in its wonderment on its way to morning.
On its way to morning. That is so beautiful. And we all have dreams and we all know what you're talking about. And I like the idea that you took sleep through the woods last night. You had something to do with what happened in the dream. Just as you get in on the inspiration when a poem starts to form, you know, you the poet and you the dreamer have some role to play here. That's what I thought was so lovely about that one.
I like that this poem too illustrates what I mean about being able to write in poetry what can't be said. Because if you were given the job to write an essay on what that poem means, yeah, I think you would have difficulty. I took sleep through the woods last night. Now you'd say, well, did he put it in his knapsack on his back and march off to the woods with a bunch of sleep? That's obviously not it. And it's right. And it's not suggested too that the author actually dreamed of the woods. So it becomes impossible to put certain things down in prose that you can write in poetry.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's true. And when you do, I find it a really good exercise. If I have a poem, an idea for a poem, and it's not coming, I'll just write in boring prose the idea. And suddenly I know how to go at it poetically. You know,
yes.
And the difference is amazing. You know, you had a dream last night with fireflies in it, in the woods. You know, but then you've said it so much more beautifully, and you've really essentially taken us inside your dream with you, which is impossible. But that's how poetry does the impossible. And your poetry often does the impossible, Stan White. I love that poem very much. I wanted to ask about your actual writing itself. Do you write on the keyboard, on the computer, or do you write with a pen or pencil first? How does that work for you?
Well, I have a friend who writes everything in a book with a pencil or with a pen. And I could never do that. First of all, because my writing is so bad, I couldn't read it afterwards. I guess probably up until about 6 or 10 years ago, I would simply write it in my head, because a lot of the poems I would write, I would get in the middle of the night and I didn't feel like getting up. I'd write them in my head, and then in the morning I would commit them to the computer. But unfortunately now, if I do get one in the night, I have no alternative but to get up and go down to the computer and put it on the computer, because I would forget it if I left it till the next morning.
Oh, so, I think most people of any age would forget it if they left it till the next morning. So that's amazing that you could hold them in your head. There's another memory practice you did.
Well, not deliberately so, but I suppose it was, yes, you know. But there's another thing I'd like to mention in this interview, Bernadette, and that is that I sometimes think that the furniture gets in the way of our writing. And if I might kind of tell you what I mean, you say take a picture, a painting on the wall.
Yeah.
Three-dimensional, it has mass, you can weigh it, you can measure it, it is in fact matter. And if you can even take every little bit of it and reduce it to its elements these days, we're so clever. But what we really should be concerned about, and I often think it's very difficult to get at, is whether or how the quality that the painting has that can make us laugh or cry. And it's an aspect of it that's particularly adept for being used for poetry. And if I can use the same analogy for music, it's much the same. When you hear a piece of music, what is it about that can affect us so much? It has nothing to do with the science of it at all, although people can reduce it to the scientific elements. What is this? I'm curious about it. I have a theory that I think, first of all, that in terms of music, that when you listen to it, it forms a pattern in your brain, which when you listen to it again, if you now know it, seeks out that pattern and it puts itself onto the pattern. But if you don't know it, of course, it doesn't do that. And I think that's generally the same with the painting too. And I wrote a piece on the painting there that might explain it a little more, if I might read it to you.
Yeah, please do.
It's called A Poet's Random Thoughts on Looking at a Painting. And it's from many years ago when I think I was involved with a little exercise we used to have with the museum down there in Dundas. And it's a poem, watercolor type, untitled, by Margaret Clark.
This is the Carnegie Museum?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, Margaret Clark was the painter whose work you used for inspiration?
Yes.
Okay.
A poet's random thoughts at looking at a painting. A painting is a very tiny space filled with a full-size world. Its medium is sunlight, how it plays with rain to make rainbows. Why do I have no choice but to think in the way this painting wants me to? Its shadows are a day's attempt to emulate a night. Painters think in darks and lights. Poets think in days and nights. A poet's purple is not purple. His blues have no right to sky. A painter's red is red. Yet all colors are words. How did she contain infinity within the thickness of the watercolor? Paintings are like poems. They are thoughts abandoned. The likes of Mona Lisa are time travelers. What must they think of streetcars? Is it easier to please the eye than to please the ear? However big the painting, the eye always has room for it. What is there about rectangles that everything must fit into them? Unlike the photograph, reality takes a tortuous route to re-canvas. Not the paper or the paint, only the colors are purely sensory. The last place a painter's thoughts leave from is the tip of her brush. Never mind galleries. In how many memories does this painting hang?
An interesting series of questions there to try to get at the magic that is painting. And you say that's not a new poem, that's an older poem.
Still a poem, yeah.
Well, Stan, you mentioned photography as being different, the effect of photography being different than the effect of painting in that poem. You mentioned this fact, which caught my imagination because I know that your day job was to be a photographer for your working life for many decades there. Are you still taking photographs, first of all?
No, I haven't taken photographs in some years. One of the problems with aging is you don't have a surplus of energy that you used to have, and climbing up and down waterfalls these days is a bit beyond what I can do. So, no, I have not really taken many photographs over the last little while.
Well, you know, as you point out, each art form does something slightly different, has a slightly different way of speaking to human emotion and human experience. Do you miss photography? Do you miss what you could get at there?
Well, first of all, I say that I was essentially an industrial photographer in England and a commercial photographer here in Canada, out of Toronto, did a lot of work for the department stores. So it wasn't really artistic photography that I was involved with. After I was retired, I got very interested in the third dimension, and I did masses of pictures in 3D stereo photography. But again, I didn't really see it as art, as being a means of factually recording the world for generations to come. So I'm probably the last person to ask that question to.
Okay, no problem. I feel that you're doing extremely fine work through the medium of poetry, but I also, and I wouldn't ask more of you, to be honest, it's just incredible what you have done as a poet. But you recently sent me a few short stories you had written, and I hadn't read your short stories in a long, long, long time. One of them was about White Island, the island off of New Zealand that erupted in volcanic action there this past winter, I guess it was, or spring, just before the COVID thing erupted, I think. You wrote an amazing story about that, which was every bit as high a quality as your best poetry. And so that just made me think, my God, you know, have you ever tried a novel?
No, I probably written maybe two or three dozen short stories, but I've never done anything with them. Occasionally they've gone into literary society collections like the Cambridge, but I haven't done anything with them. I suppose have always written for myself, and I think if you need to be recognized, you've got to have a lot of energy to get your stuff out there. And frankly, I really haven't, as you know, not that much. So one of the great things about poetry is that you can say an incredible amount in a very short number of words, and that suits
you. Yes, it's a wonderful aspect of poetry, yes.
Yeah. So I'd find writing a novel a terrible chore.
Well, you never know. I would put nothing past you, Stan White. I want to remind our listeners that you tuned in to Art Waves on 101.5 The Hawk, and that I'm Bernadette Rule, and my guest tonight is Stan White, poet and once upon a time photographer as well, and also excellent short story writer. So just a couple of last things before we wrap it up. Stan White, where can people get a hold of your work? Say they wanted to get a copy of one of your books.
I don't really have any that are extant at the moment. You know, you get them and you get a bunch of them and you give them away to people. And I don't really have any to be able to do that. I guess that's a shortcoming.
Are your books in the libraries at all?
I don't think so. There may be one. I think there was one, an early one, that did get in the library.
Oh, this is a great loss. I'm going to see if I can't write this wrong somehow. But in any case, it's been a joy to have you back on Art Waves. And was there a last poem you'd like to read for us before we go to the music?
Yeah, what should I read to you? Yeah, I can. I'll read just this piece called Prelude to an Epitaph. And you were talking there a little while ago about really influences the need to write. And sometimes you get a situation where you want to be able to encapsulate it in some way and express yourself. And I think that is what this poem is. It's called Prelude to an Epitaph. It's a bit outdated now. Okay, Prelude to an Epitaph. 40 years approaching 5 and dwindling. This unfathomed manufactory assembles thoughts from the demolition of a lifetime's dream. Head, heart, belly, loins, and fragments of the boy, the youth, man, shreds for mad coyotes baying to the moon.
Oh my God. Well, that reminds me of Yeats, W.B. Yeats, and his many poems about the aging body.
That's right. A World for Old Men. I remember that one, yes.
Right. Quite moving and chilling, honestly. I hate to end on that. But you've chosen quite a nice piece of music for us, and it's something I had never heard before. To close with, you chose Renee Fleming's Ain't It a Pretty Night from the opera Susanna.
Yeah.
Why did you choose that one?
Well, Renee Fleming is one of my, in fact, probably my favorite soprano. And Ain't It a Pretty Night it's an aria from an opera, but it's a little bit different from what she's normally singing, which is the classic Verdi and Puccini. The opera Susanna has two very good arias in it, and that is one of them, and I particularly like it.
All right. Anything else you'd like to say to our audience before we wind it up and play Renee Fleming's Ain't It a Pretty Night?
Just thank you very much for inviting me, Bernadette. I really appreciate it, and you know, it's an opportunity for the garrulous old man to really enjoy himself. So thank you. And to our audience, be sure to wear a mask and social distance. And
yes, indeed.
I shall wash my hand after this too.
Okay. Well, excellent to have you back on Art Waves. And we will not wait so long the next time. This has been a real treat for me, Stan White. Thanks a million. And we always thank our listeners for tuning in. You make a big difference to our conversation knowing that you're there, the fourth wall or whatever they call it. We're very happy that you tune in. And I hope you can join me next week. We're live every Sunday. We're not live, but we're aired every Sunday night at 7 p.m. on 101.5 The Hawk. And then you can listen to all podcasts of past Art Waves programs by going to archive.org/details/artwaves, where you will find many wonderful interviews with Stan White on various aspects of writing poetry. So thank you all. Hope you can join me for the next one. And until then, this is Bernadette Rule wishing you a good night on the shores of Lake Ontario.
See we beyond where we can. They can see we beyond.